2 weeks ago, we looked at Acts 13. The Holy Spirit directed Paul and Barnabas to undertake this new mission after their work at Antioch. So they visited Cyprus, and that was fairly successful. Then half the chapter was Paul's sermon to the synagogue in the city in Antioch. But the Jews ended up rejecting the message about Jesus and incited opposition that forced Paul and Barnabas to flee and go to Iconium. Looking at chapter 13 and 14 together, it seems to me that the central event of the story has to be the visit to Pisidian Antioch. And, of course, the big thing in that story is Paul's speech. If nothing else, the speech is illustrative, I think, of the message that Paul and Barnabas were proclaiming on this trip. And I wondered if there isn't more to it, if somehow it's not supposed to influence how we understand the whole story of this journey. But I didn't really come up with any good answers for that. Thinking about that, though, it occurred to me if the heart of the story is that synagogue speech, then before and after that, there is a miracle story involving Paul, and the story begins and ends with them in Antioch. So maybe I've just seen too many of Tom's outlines and he's had a bad influence on me, but I wondered if there could be some kind of structure to the chapters 13 and 14 together, this whole journey and how Luke tells it. Any thoughts on that real quick before we move on? Hannah has an opinion. Okay, well, let's pick up at the beginning of chapter 14. In Iconium, they entered the synagogue of the Jews together and spoke in such a manner that a large number of the people believed, both of Jews and of Greeks. But the Jews who disbelieved stirred up the minds of the Gentiles and embittered them against the brethren. Therefore they spent a long time there speaking boldly with reliance upon the Lord, who was testifying to the word of his grace, granting that signs and wonders be done by their hands. But the people of the city were divided, and some sided with the Jews and some with the apostles. And when an attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to mistreat and to stone them, they became aware of it and fled to the cities of Lycaonia, Lystra, and Derbe, and the surrounding region. And there they continued to preach the gospel. So in keeping with the practice we have seen before in Cyprus and Antioch, Paul and Barnabas first visit the synagogue. And the Jews there, some of them accept the message, but apparently a good number of them do not. And they don't just reject the message about Jesus, they feel driven to spur others to be opposed to it as well. It kind of reminds me of what Jesus said about the lawyers in Luke 12, and he said something very similar about the Pharisees in Matthew 23, that they not only reject God's kingdom, but they hinder others from entering it. But whereas Jesus said those things specifically about the lawyers or the Pharisees, it seems like that's becoming more and more true of the Jews in general everywhere the gospel goes. We see again in verse 3 how God is, in a direct way, involved in the story and acting, in this case, through the miracles that are being performed. In verse 4 and also in verse 14, Barnabas and Paul together are referred to as apostles. But apostle is not a technical religious term. It's just a transliteration of a word that means messenger or envoy, something like that. So it probably reflects here not that Barnabas was equal with the 12, but that Paul and Barnabas were sent out by the Holy Spirit or by the church at Antioch. And then overall, this part of the story is kind of an abbreviated account of what happened in the last chapter at Antioch. They preach in the synagogue, some people believe, but the Jews reject the message, stir up persecution, and force them to leave. Any thoughts about this, the visit to Iconium?
It does seem to be a trend as well, but it's not when the Jews get those who don't believe want to cause trouble, they stir up the Gentiles. So we've seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's going to Mm-hmm. I mean, once the Gentiles already don't like the Jews, and now they just see the Christians as an offshoot of the Jews. I don't know. It was not a wise thing.
Any other thoughts? Oh, well, we haven't got there yet. You're jumping ahead. When we read the part of the story where they call him Zeus, we can... Okay, well, let's pick up then in verse 8. At Lystra, a man was sitting who had no strength in his feet, lame from his mother's womb, who had never walked. Before I go on, I just have to say, Luke is really emphasizing that this guy couldn't walk. He tells us three different ways. This man was listening to Paul as he spoke, who, when he had fixed his gaze on him and had seen that he had faith to be made well, said with a loud voice, "Stand upright on your feet." And he leapt up and began to walk. When the crowd saw what Paul had done, they raised their voice, saying in the Lycaonian language, "The gods have become like men and have come down to us." And they began calling Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. The priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifice with the crowds. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they tore their robes and rushed out into the crowd, crying out and saying, "Men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you, and preach the gospel to you that you should turn from these vain things and to a living God, who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In the days gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways. And he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness." Even saying these things, with difficulty they restrained the crowds from offering sacrifice to them. So, last chapter we saw Paul confront a magician, which was something that Peter did, and now he heals a man who was lame from birth, which was something Peter did. In both of the stories, the apostle fixed his gaze on the lame man. In both the story, he commands the lame man to get up, and the man does and starts leaping and walking. In both stories, there was a temple nearby. The temple in Jerusalem in the first case, and in this instance, the temple of Zeus was apparently somewhere nearby. Paul's command here doesn't mention Jesus the way that Peter did back in Acts 3, but since we're told that the man had been listening to Paul as he was speaking, and that Paul saw that he had responded with trust, presumably he did know who Jesus was by this point. And as in Acts 3, the miracle not only heals the physical defect of whatever physically was wrong with the man, but also immediately imparts to him the skill necessary to walk. It's like he has to learn to walk now that he's able to. In a parallel to a very different story, back in chapter 13, Paul fixed his gaze on Bar-Jesus before striking him blind. In this case, he fixes his gaze on someone to heal them, though. The begging crowds conclude that Paul and Barnabas must be gods, and even, not just gods, but they assign them these specific gods. One interesting point I ran across was the idea that maybe if they, because in mythology, Hermes was a son of Zeus, perhaps the fact that they identified Barnabas as Zeus and Paul as Hermes could imply that Barnabas was a fair bit older than Paul. I don't know, but I thought that was an interesting thought. What's ironic is that the people are actually correct in seeing the miracle as evidence that God had become like men and come down to us. They were right that divine power was at work. The only problem was that God in the flesh was not Paul and Barnabas, but Jesus. And so Paul and Barnabas reject the attempt at worship, which is something that we saw Peter do before, but which we did not see Herod do. It is odd that in verse 14, the order is Barnabas and Paul. That is a peculiarity, because normally Luke, after switching Paul's name over to Paul from Saul. It's almost always Paul and Barnabas. But maybe here it's because it's a reflection of the order of significance that the crowds were assigning the men. They try to direct the crowd's attention to the real God. They describe him as the creator of everything, and that even when he permitted people to kind of go their own way, he still testified to his existence through the good things that he provided. According to Paul itself, the world and the good things that it contains are, on their own, sufficient evidence for mankind to conclude that there is a creator God and that, you know, we should have reason to seek him. This is one of only two speeches in Acts that is directed towards a totally pagan audience. The other one is in Athens in Acts 17. And both of those, they identify God's activity in nature as evidence of his existence. They talk about how God formerly let the nations all do their own thing, but now is engaging with them more actively and has some greater expectation of them. The argument also calls to mind Romans 1, where Paul says that the creation alone was sufficient evidence of God's existence and power, that people should have acknowledged him. Neither this speech nor the one in Acts 17 actually mentions Jesus directly. Paul does kind of refer to him obliquely in as someone who was resurrected from the dead in Acts 17, but he's not the focus of the message as we see it here. But he's speaking to pagan audiences in these instances who, you know, the idea of the Jewish Messiah doesn't mean anything to them. They have no familiarity with the God of the Jews. And so you have to start out there, you know, with just the fact that there is this creator God that you need to acknowledge. One commentary made the interesting point that where you begin presenting the gospel can vary widely, but it always ends up with Jesus, regardless of what the starting point is. This speech, and also the one in Acts 17, I thought was interesting to think about what a contrast they are to the other speeches that we see in Acts. They aren't full of quoting scripture and talking about who Jesus was and what the Jews did to him. Instead, they're focused on these other themes. Verse 17 is a little bit of a counterpart to back in verse 3, in that both talk about how God provided witness for himself, but in different ways. In the one case, it was through miracles. In the other case, it's through the creation and the good things that it contains.
Does Acts show a trend in terms of trying to find evidence, but showing as empirical proof that this guy wasn't just a plant necessarily, that he even lame from his birth, kind of like the blind man in John, like he'd been lame from birth and he wasn't just a plant in a vinny pen?
What is your opinion of that, Nathan? Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't recall anything up to this point in Acts. I mean, there haven't been, you know, there's not nearly as many miracles being performed in Acts as we saw with Jesus in the Gospels. Yes, I mean, he was the other guy who was, you know, he was lame from birth. Couch potato.
The function here may be to show more Paul parallel to Peter.
Mm-hmm.
That was Peter than Paul's doing.
Yeah, that definitely seems to be part of the story. I mean, there's certainly miracles where there's not really, you know, like with Paul striking Bar-Jesus blind, or when they cast out the demon from the woman in Philippi, where there's not really the kinds of details provided that really strike me as being included specifically for some sort of evidentiary purpose. Possible.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is the work of God. And it's, I mean, that in itself is something of a microcosm of what you see in all of Acts, of the Jews rejecting Jesus and the Gentiles accepting him.
That is a good point.
Not exactly that, because they've got their, you know, they've got their radar off a little bit, so to speak.
They've got the wrong God they're attributing
right,
this to.
Right. But they recognize the hand of God.
Yeah, they draw the right conclusion in that sense. Other thoughts about this part of the story?
It's interesting to note in verse 9, details given that he had faith to be healed. Because there's mm-hmm. sometimes, like the parallel one in chapter 3 says nothing about whether he had faith
mm-hmm.
or not. So what's the point of mentioning that other than just maybe giving him some credit?
There are plenty of times where Jesus says something to the effect of, your faith has made you well. So, although that's not true of all miracles, that certainly, the belief on the part of the person does seem to play some function in it. I don't know that we can really explain the metaphysics of miracles. That's kind of the whole point of them.
Spiritualizing at the point, because I mean, literally what the text says, he had faith to be saved. And of course, if you translate it that way, it makes it sound like spiritual salvation. That's how you normally use the term.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, saved can be used for physical healing or spiritual.
Uh-huh.
And I guess you could legitimately argue he saw that this man was a believer and ready to act on his faith, and even wanted to be baptized in preparatory to that is, you know, heal it so you get up and go jump in the baptistry or whatever. I mean, you know, we're not, it doesn't dwell upon the baptism, obviously, this particular case. But, and I wondered even in the case of Jesus, you know, your faith has made you well. If Jesus merely means you've been physically healed because you have faith, or if it's even a deeper meaning that you have found the real healing, you know, your physical healing. Mm-hmm. Finding the real answer to your problems, that kind of thing. So those prophetic kinds of issues.
Any other thoughts? Okay. Let's pick up in verse 19. But Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, and having won over the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. But while the disciples stood around him, he got up and entered the city. The next day he went away with Barnabas to Derbe. And after they had preached the gospel to that city and had made many disciples, they returned to Lystra and to Iconium and to Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples, encouraging them to continue in the faith, and saying, through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of God. When they'd appointed elders for them in every church, having prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord in whom they had believed. They passed through Pisidia and came into Pamphylia. When they'd spoken the word in Perga, they went down to Italia. From there they sailed to Antioch, from which they had been commended to the grace of God for the work that they had accomplished. When they had arrived and gathered the church together, they began to report all the things that God had done with him, and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. and they spent a long time with the disciples. So unlike in previous cities, it is not the local Jews who lead opposition. Instead, it is the Jews in the previous two cities who are so dedicated to opposing Paul that they chase after him to, you know, this other city in order to rouse a mob to lynch him. This might fit with why there's no mention of going to the synagogue in Lystra. Maybe there just weren't that many Jews living in the city. That's why you had to get astroturfed rabble rousers, so to speak. This represents kind of the climax of Jewish opposition we've seen over the course of this journey. First, they encounter Bar-Jesus, who's trying to, you know, not using force necessarily, but is trying to oppose them. And then in Antioch, the Jews get upset and drive them out of the city. And then in Iconium, we're told there's actually a specific plan to kill them. And then here, they actually follow through and do stone Paul and think they've killed him. The reversal that takes place here, where the crowds go from thinking that Paul is a god to forming a lynch mob to stone him, kind of reminds me of what happened with Jesus. He shows up in Jerusalem one day and is hailed as king, and a few days later they're killing him. There's also a parallel here to Paul himself in that the Jews chasing after him from Antioch and Iconium to Lystra is reminiscent of the way he was pursuing the disciples from Jerusalem to Damascus. In Iconium and Lystra and also Antioch, we see the Jews who oppose Paul and Barnabas appeal to the non-Jewish locals for aid in their campaign of persecution. It's as if their hatred for this message about Jesus is so strong that it could motivate them to at least temporarily set aside their sense of racial superiority and disdain for the Gentiles and go asking these pagans for help, essentially. Whether they literally, you know, framed their communications in terms of requests for help, I doubt, but that's effectively what they're doing. We don't like you, we look down upon you, but if you'll help us get rid of Paul and Barnabas, then we'll work with you. The gospel brought Jew and Greek together, as we saw back in Acts 10. And ironically, opposition to the gospel does the same thing in bringing them together. And this is an idea Luke has presented before, back in Luke 23, which I believe is unique to Luke. None of the other gospels have this. He mentions how Herod Antipas and Pilate had been enemies, but then Pilate sending Jesus to Herod for trial was the catalyst for them to become friends. And even earlier than that, you have Jesus' statements back in Luke 9 and Luke 11, that along the lines of, you know, he who is not against you is for you, he who is not with me is against me. All other distinctions pale in comparison to the difference between whether you are on Jesus' side or opposed to him. And that's by far the most important defining distinction there can be. I think that that's at least illustrated by this, the way these people that you wouldn't expect to work together can work together to oppose the gospel. It's not stated explicitly, but it seems pretty much impossible to me that Paul could have been stoned and thought dead and then get right back up without some kind of divine intervention here. So it doesn't say there's a miracle here, but it sure seems like God must have, you know, kept him alive. The other thing that was interesting when he gets up in verse 20, while the disciples stood around him, well, where did these disciples come from? There hasn't actually been any mention in the story so far in Lystra of them making any disciples. But presumably some amount of time passed from the incident with the, you know, attempt to offer sacrifices to when they stone him. And so there has been, you know, some success with the gospel that took place. I feel like the exhortation about, you know, expecting tribulations to enter the kingdom, coming from a guy who has very recently survived being stoned and is revisiting cities where lynch mobs chased him out of the city, had to have been a very powerful message for those people to hear. The statement also seems to imply that in some sense, entering the kingdom is something that we have yet to do, or that it's an ongoing event. And normally I think we think of being in church as being in the kingdom already. But this really fits with what we've talked about, I think, a number of times before, about how in different senses it's true that the kingdom is already come, and in the sense that it's in the current process of coming, and in a sense that it's only yet to come in the future. So I think there's something similar to that here. I just thought that was interesting. Interesting how he described that. The rest of the chapter briefly summarizes some further travels. The visit to Derbe is hardly described at all. But it is interesting that it's the only city they visit where there isn't a report of encountering opposition. I don't know if that means there was any opposition or if it just means that Luke didn't find it necessary to discuss it. And then they revisit these cities and they appoint elders, or as Tom and I were discussing earlier, at least they have some role in getting elders appointed. And then they pass through several other places and return to Antioch. The report they give of their journey emphasizes God as the main actor. They report all the things that God had done with them and how he had opened the door of faith with the Gentiles. Which, again, is continuing the theme we keep seeing through Acts of God actively playing a role in the world. It's interesting that the text uses he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles as this metaphor for, you know, the opportunity to evangelize, because Paul uses an open door as a metaphor for the opportunity to evangelize in 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians and Colossians. And it certainly sounds like an expression that Paul might have used to describe what he had been doing. The focus of the report, or at least what we're told of it, is the spreading of the gospel to the Gentiles, not on the Jewish opposition everywhere. It fits the whole trip back into the larger narrative we've been seeing of the gospel gradually spreading, you know, from Jerusalem out through the whole world. Comments?
Mm-hmm. And I guess that tension between Jew and Gentile and that kind of Jewish racism is going to bleed into chapter 15 as this question of circumcision.
Yeah, certainly it seems like this whole journey, chapters 13 and 14 together, and this, you know, unprecedented new spread of the gospel to the Gentiles sets up, well, okay, now what, you know, how exactly does this work, which is what they deal with in the next chapter. Guy?
The appointment of elders in these churches that have been established seems to be contrary to what we interpret the 1 Timothy about the qualifications of elders. These men are fairly young in the faith. Now, what their background was, of course, if they were Jews, they had a background in the old law and so on, but they didn't have a great deal of time to grasp the gospel, and yet they're appointed elders or shepherds of the flock already. So I wonder if we put too much emphasis on the length of time that a man has been a child of God before he can be appointed a shepherd or elder.
I mean, I believe the only like specific comments on terms of elders is that he's not a new convert. So how exactly you define that, what is not a new convert, I mean, I don't know that we can, you know, nail down, well, you must have been baptized this many, you know, months ago for you to qualify as not a new convert. I mean, certainly the overall emphasis in the descriptions about elders and Timothy and Titus emphasizes their proven character. And that unquestionably takes time to establish. Exactly how long, again, I don't think we should be trying to fix a specific time length, like, you know, we have to, you know, observe this person for this many years exactly before we can establish this. Charlie? That's a sad indictment of the teaching that Christian has heard for the past 20 years.
or the diligence to learn. But, so it often defines, you know, the heart and how much they want to learn, how fast they want to learn, or it could just be the ability of the person to learn. You know, you could sit down and read history for, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours a day versus how to fall asleep in 10 minutes. So, it, you know, if they're willing to sit there and learn, they can learn a whole lot faster if they have that mindset and that ability. Or if the apostles laid their hands on them and gave them the gift of knowledge. That's it. You know, so we're kind of, you know, trying to apply something that could have been a gift with we can only do what we can do.
I do think it seems at least a very plausible explanation that there were Jews or those God-fearing Gentiles that, you know, would go to the synagogue, that there would have been people who already know this God, at least they know something about him. They already know the scriptures, and so these aren't necessarily all just pagans who are starting from scratch to know anything about God. Nathan?
I think it's a natural thing for us to hear about a new convert and presume that they need to know more. But what Paul actually says is not a new convert lest he become puffed up and conceit and fall into condemnation. He ties it in with the problem of pride, not the problem of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something, as we think about that, you know, how exactly does being a new convert lead to the problem of pride potentially is a different sort of question, but it's worth noting that what Paul emphasizes is the problem of pride, not the problem of ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Tom?
Yeah, you know, of course, the word that Paul uses in 1 Timothy 3 is neophyte, which we have an English word that comes from that, a novice. And, you know, I've known some Christians 30 years, you know, been Christians for 30 years, and they were novices still, you know. So it isn't just a matter of time. And I think you're right that probably a lot of these people, if you'd ask them if they were converted, they'd say, no, I've been worshiping God, the one true God, all my life.
And I'm still worshiping him. I'm just worshiping him now, understanding about Jesus.
What they were missing out on is knowing that all the promises they've been studying their whole life have now been fulfilled that's quite different. You know, they still had that strength of character and raised their families and, you know, that kind of thing. I think something similar would be if you had, you know, some Christians moved to the area and started worshiping with you, and, you know, in a couple of months you get to know this person, and they're just a very solid, mature, you know, Christian man. He's raised his family elsewhere and so on. I mean, how long does he have to be a member there before you might say, this is a man we could appoint as an elder? You know, you have 5-year minimum, you know, or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like people fall in love and get married within a month, you know. I mean, it can happen, you know. You can get to know some people quickly. But the important thing, again, would be, you know, is mature, have exhibited, been tested in this proven character and raising his family. So I think surely that's the case here, where, you know, Paul's returning back for these churches. You kind of alluded to, I don't see Paul as saying, you are elders, and nobody has any say-so. If that's not a definition of lording it over, I don't know what is. You know, and the Bible clearly forbids that kind of tyrannical, you know, imposition of the will on people.
Mm-hmm.
But he taught them they needed leadership and how to go about doing that, and, you know, who the people were that would qualify for that. So.
Okay.
Wouldn't the term appointment here, as in Acts chapter 6, indicate that there had been a selection in the congregations of those that they felt were called upon?
I mean, that certainly seems like that would be the most logical way to, you know, understand what took place. Yeah. Did I see someone else's hand? Adam?
Jews asked, by what power or in what name have you done this? And we, you know, Nathan pointed out, these people in Lystra had no trouble figuring out that it was a God.
Mm-hmm.
Had the power of a God. And where these Jews are so foolish that they're literally sent, you know, they see a man healed and they go, how did you do this? And so if these Gentiles are able to listen to Paul and become believers, then they have something inside of them already that makes them wiser and to be possibly good leaders.
That's an interesting thought.
Having previous knowledge of the scripture necessarily.
Evangelistic zeal misdirected in this way, and it makes you wonder, you know, that in our own time, I've known some preachers that are just real gung-ho about, you know, rooting out false teachers and calling them by name and so on and so forth, but, and certain railing against, you know, false doctrine of this, that, or that denomination, but didn't seem to translate into a similar kind of evangelistic fervor of taking the gospel. You know, you're always carping about what's wrong. What's not right, but what is the gospel? What is the truth? I'm trying to bring people to the Lord instead of just keep them from error. You know,
yeah.
One little thing, the detail about how they prayed and fasted when they, you know.
Yes. I do wonder if there's not supposed to be a parallel back into chapter 13, where they fasted and prayed and laid their hands on them and sent away Paul and Barnabas. So you see this similar treatment taking place.
Yeah, I mean, just the idea of fasting to focus on some important spiritual effort. There's probably a lot to be said, and this is a quite a tangent, I guess, but there's probably a lot to be said for going on fast of various kinds, media, entertainment, all kinds of things that we distract ourselves with. I mean, they're going to say, we're going to take away some time from food so we can focus on spiritual things on this. And in our culture, with all the distractions we have, you go without food, you can still find plenty of other ways to distract yourself, not be focused. And just saying, I'm really going to focus on this. It's spiritually important enough that not even eating, I don't even want to eat right now because this is what we're focused on. Probably an important thing for us to consider.
Sure.
Yeah, I do think the important point there is fasting is not about how much food you are taking into your body. It's a time management thing. The preparation of food in the natural world would have taken what would appear to us to be an exorbitant amount of time.
Oh, that's a good point.
I mean, we just take the TV dinner out of the freezer, pop it in the microwave, and full meal is ready in 3 minutes. So if you redeem all of that time you would have spent preparing the food as well as eating it, you freed up an enormous amount of time. That's why I think that was right. If you want to practice fasting today, it isn't, I'm not going to eat today and play video games for 23 hours and think about spiritual things for 30 minutes or something. It's setting aside your ordinary routine and focusing so much on that everything else just,
whatever that ordinary routine happens to involve.
And for most people in the ancient world, that was eating, they just preparing your food and eating it day to day.
Okay, well, we will stop there.